Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel and to our open discussion of issues in the news and beyond. We have a great panel for you this morning, and I will introduce them to you in just a moment. Before I do that, let me remind you that you can be a part of our conversation. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org, and you can weigh in on the items that we will talk about. Let me introduce our panel to you, two holdovers from yesterday. We're great, wonderful to have them back, but I missed them, so it's great to have them both here. Daily Gazette editor Judy Patrick joins us. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Joe.
And political consultant Libby Post is with us.
We good never morning. Left, you know.
Right, you're just
here. We were just hanging. We slept here. It was great. Took a shower.
It's very nice here on the Avenue. And Albany Bureau Chief for Politico. It's been a while since he's been on the program. We're thrilled to have him back. Jimmy Vielkind is in the house.
Happy
morning,
to be
sir.
Back.
How are you?
Very well.
So we obviously are going to start with the tragedy that happened in San Bernardino, California yesterday. Programming announcement, but around 10:30 or so, we're going to, a little after about 10:40, we're going to run an interview that I did last night with Gloria Steinem. I had the opportunity to interview Gloria Steinem last night in New York, and this woman is incredible. Just absolutely amazing of what she's accomplished. We taped a book show, but we taped a segment where we talked about the shooting, specifically the shooting. This was as news was emerging from San Bernardino. We were talking about the shooting that happened last week, last Friday, at the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Colorado. So as we were having this conversation, it's just, and you saw this again in the frustration of the president of, you know, here we go, and we're gonna talk about this once again. So the situation is heavily armed men and women terrorized the city of San Bernardino, California on Wednesday, killing at least 14 people and wounding at least 17 at a social services center before leading the police on a manhunt, culminating in a shootout that left the two suspects dead. Panic, chaos, and rumor gripped the working class community about 60 miles east of Los Angeles as the attackers carried out the nation's worst mass shooting since the assault on an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, nearly 3 years ago. That number surprised me, actually. I thought we had surpassed that since then. Because of the great regularity that these stories come out, but that is true. It is the second worst mass shooting since the assault in Newtown. I guess when we talk about these stories, the question always has to come, which is, well, is this going to be the event, or is this going to be the final thing that is going to change people and change people's minds? And I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know what more can happen. I just, you know, there have been 352 shootings. We have 365 days in a year.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
There were two yesterday.
There was three. It wasn't a mass shooting. Yesterday, there was a woman killed at a women's health center in Houston, Texas.
Yes.
There was the one in Georgia.
In Savannah, yes.
Right. And then what happened in San Bernardino. And it's unfathomable to people who think. That's all I can say. It really is. For people who think and recognize the issue that there's a direct connection between guns and killing people, that we continue to do this. You know, I was in Paris during the attacks. You know, people got killed, but there wasn't a bunch of cowboys out there shooting other people up, and which is what somebody on the boat said should have happened. And it's just unfathomable to me, because in no other civilized Western country does this happen.
There's the umbrella issue, of course, which is the regularity and also the gun issue. But the particular case here is interesting because it doesn't quite fit the mold in two ways. One, there this was at a Christmas party or a holiday party, and it seemed police, and again, very early in the investigation, but law enforcement officials are saying that it seemed to be a very carefully planned attack, because there was the weapons, there were the masks, the car, everything else. And then there was the case that there seemed to be some sort of event that happened at the party, mm-hmm. that caused the anger that led to this tragedy.
Well, it's I think it's really it's striking that we don't know what these people were motivated by. We do know everything you just said, Joe, and we know that this deviates from different mass shootings that we talk about. We don't know if these people were mentally ill. We don't know if they were just trying to terrorize. We don't know if this was a coworker dispute or something. And, you know, it's always difficult to talk about these kinds of incidents in the early hours, because I think those facts are really important, and they sort of temper in trying to know what exactly went on. One thing that I read in the Los Angeles Times was that there were four firearms used. I guess you can call them weapons based on how they were used yesterday. But four firearms used, two of which were purchased legally. We also know that California has very strict gun control laws. We also know that President Obama is once again calling for tighter federal gun controls. And we're seeing sort of the same feedback loop that we always see after these mass shootings. It tends to be Democrats who call for tighter gun control laws. You know, the gun rights advocates usually keep very quiet and keep a low profile in the immediate aftermath of incidents like these. But then nothing gets done. The status quo just sort of continues along. And it goes to Libby's point of what more can happen. And, you know, again, to go back to the first point of we don't know exactly what motivated this. We don't know the why. I think that bespeaks to a larger problem, in that I don't feel that there's even a consensus that there's a public policy problem, right? Like we understand there's a problem of heroin use, right?
Right.
So this is something that's generally acknowledged. And you can then disagree about the approaches that you need to do to combat the heroin epidemic. There'll be people who say tougher penalties, there'll be people who say reduce access to drugs, et cetera, et cetera. Here, you look at these incidences of mass shootings, you know, we're not even there at the first order. Right? Everyone condemns them, but are these, as some contend, including very powerful politicians, is this just the act of some madman and madwoman? Is this a terrorist, you know, a terrorist incident, et cetera? And so we can't even talk about a public policy response or a lack of a public policy response, if that's the decision, before we get there. And Libby is shaking her head, and I see is kind of seething a little bit.
No. It's, you know, some people in the public health field have been talking about this as a public health issue, that guns are definitely impacting public health with the amount of people that were killed. But what I find strange is, and maybe I'm totally off base with this, but you guys are in the media. I'm just trying to influence you all the time. But
yeah, stop it.
Yeah, stop it. Okay. When the shooting happened in Newtown, it seemed like they had information on this guy like right away. We knew who this guy was. They were talking about who got killed. They were talking about the families. There seems to be either they really don't know or there's some kind of information block going on, because it's been over 12 hours and there's still no sense of who these people are. There's no talking about who the victims are or anything like that. And I just found that a little weird.
I have a theory, but I think it's scary, which is that it's because they're Muslim.
Well, and the other thing is sometimes when we find out those details about shootings or perpetrators of acts like these, you know, they've left behind a manifesto or a diary or a note or a something, and it's very, very quickly apparent. I forget the young man who was involved in the Virginia Tech shooting.
Yes.
But, you know, he mailed a video, I think, to one of the major news networks. So there's a little ambiguity about what transpired and what motivated him.
Might be there was more information than
but
that.
But I tend to be a little bit more patient about this. I think that we do know that the man worked for the county, that
yes.
he was a restaurant
mm-hmm.
inspector.
He was an employee.
That he grew up, was born and raised in this country, has a family. So I think it does take a little bit of time to to ferret that information out. And the other thing is the news media probably is knocking on the door of his family, and maybe the brother-in-law, I think, is talking a little bit.
Brother-in-law has come out and was very concerned about the impact that this would have that would cause an anti-Muslim sentiment, spoke to the media, but and has been cooperating with law enforcement, of course. But there was that initial response where they said we are not going to rule out terrorism. We are not going to rule out terrorism.
You know, in my mind, it's terrifying. You know, yes, the word terrorism is we tend to think, oh, well, if it's, you know, international terrorism, it's really not our problem. And that really shuts down the discussion about gun violence in this country. After Newtown, where they're shooting first graders, you would think
that makes any, you know, I mean, that will never make any sense in the world of something like that happening. And yet it doesn't yield anything meaningful other than what the individual states, including New York, that pass legislation.
As long as the gun lobby has the power it has, and the NRA can funnel tens of millions of dollars into Republican coffers, it's not going
to Well, let me get to something that Jimmy just said that I thought was interesting, which is that it's hard to come up with what public policy did work and or what lapses we have as a result of this, you know, so soon after. But my God, I mean, as Libby pointed out, we've got a track record here. You know, there's 355 incidents just in the calendar year 2015, not to mention events that have taken prior. And I don't know, is that fair to lump them all together?
Hey, let's talk about gun violence in general, because it's not just mass shootings, it's domestic violence incidents. It's
absolutely
it's
about
robbery.
Half are domestic violence.
Yes.
And half of the victims are women. Let's not, you know, this is a major, and I guess one of my points is, why don't we just study this more and talk about it more sensibly? And at the same time, apparently some researchers were on Capitol Hill yesterday looking for more funding for this kind of research, and they got
Well, the Republicans down. Shut them down. The Republicans said no to more funding on gun violence research. And so they just shut them down. But, you know, just get rid of the AK-47s. They used to not be available to the general public. You know,
they're
for
not
a very
available
long
in
time.
New York.
Right, and they're not available in New York, but just get rid of the AK-47s, and I think you'll see a.
I don't mean to oversimplify this, but in my little Joe brain, I understand right to bear arms. I understand wanting to protect oneself. I understand wanting to hunt. I'm not a gun guy. I've never had a gun. I don't know, but I do not understand why we need assault rifles.
Mm-hmm. We don't
of things that kill many people at one time.
Well, you know, there are people who don't think the way you do,
and
there
are I know that.
Yeah, there are people who would
on
say
on so many levels.
And there are
Jimmy.
People, but there are people who would say, and I'm so you know, there are people who would say, and you know, I talked to a lot of people after the SAFE Act passed in 2013 here, and you know, there are people who view the right to bear arms as it was originally instilled as a check against oppression. If the populace of this country was armed, the king or the czar or the president or whomever could not come in and repress. And that is it. And there are people who would look at someone like you and say, it's not about hunting. It's not about sports shooting.
But
this
even
was,
personal
this was
protection.
Designed.
Even right. personal protection. But what I'm wondering, even
well, there are other people who would say that's crazy. The government is not going to come and oppress you. And
yes, I don't understand how we have states that don't have fireworks. We have states that you know I have to show three forms of ID to buy Tylenol.
It's harder to get a driver's license.
And I know these are very anecdotal and silly, but you do have to wonder at what point of where we are where guns can be easily obtained. And again, I'm talking about assault rifles that can do so much harm and fall into the hands of many times young kids.
I think there has been polling that shows that even among gun owners, there is support for some common sense protections like universal background checks or, I guess, requiring people to lock up their guns at home. Maybe
we can't even get that far.
But I think maybe we'll have the discussion this time. What do you think? Is now the time, or do we wait a few days until people at this?
I don't know. And here's another question I had, and I don't have the answer to this, but I don't know if any of you do. Do you readily buy body armor? The people had body armor. I mean, is that difficult to obtain? I mean, when you think of somebody's buying body armor, that maybe there's a reason they have body armor?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
And the guns they were using, I think, could pierce body armor or some low level of body armor. So the guns they used, the police officers may not have been protected if they had come in contact with them.
I don't know where. I mean, again, I'm not making light of this. I don't know where you go to buy body armor.
Well, we should just Google and see what you could buy.
Yeah.
Well, somebody just wrote on Twitter that AK-47s are not allowed in California unless you were grandfathered in before the current law.
Yes, that's right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to some letters. We'll talk a little bit more about this issue, and then we'll move on to other things as well. We welcome your comments. Roundtable@WAMC.org. Roundtable@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, we have Libby Post, Judy Patrick, and Jimmy Vilkind with us this morning, and we welcome your comments. Roundtable@WAMC.org. Roundtable@WAMC.org. We got many letters, and I want to read a few of them this morning before we move on to some other issues. Michael says, gun laws do not prevent gun violence. This culture of violence we embrace in popular media is a cause. Mental illness is another factor that needs addressing. I certainly agree with the second part of that sentiment. Jack says, I'm as disgusted as much as the next person by the gun lobby and the proliferation of gun violence, but I must say that you all are not helping anything by going over and over the same old rap that you have done so many times before. Being right, in my opinion, is not enough. We need totally new thinking on this issue. And when I listened to you this morning, I must say that it sounds just like the last umpteen time that you have addressed this issue every time we have another shooting. Well, I think that's kind of the point, isn't
right.
it? It's why do we still keep on having this discussion where
and there's only
more
so
than
much
a dozen people are dead.
The four of us can do. It has to be the people who we elect to office who are going to make some change.
I think we all have to start talking about it and figure out what we're going to do. Jane says, just as the tobacco companies were accountable for cancer causing, why aren't gun manufacturers accountable for gun violence? Kathy says, this morning my son-in-law posted the Second Amendment is already dead. Every mass shooting has occurred where it is nearly impossible to get a concealed carry permit or carrying with a permit is forbidden. When people say things like this, all I can imagine is war in the streets with untrained, undisciplined, unorganized, reactive people making life and death decisions based on their individual angry perspective.
I think about that too.
Yeah.
It's like the OK Corral.
Well, I remember talking with a police officer a while back who said that he's always out and he's always got a gun and he's always carrying. And I thought to myself, good, great. I want you to always be armed, but I don't know if
it's
going to help others. Yeah. Sorry, Joe.
No, that's fine. Bonnie writes, in the Connecticut case, terrorism derived from a mentally unbalanced young man whose first act was to kill his mother. It may be she was about to have him committed, and she obviously underestimated the danger. His terrorism only then continued onto the small children at the Sandy Hook School. In essence, he visited the terror of his demons on us. We got this, which is from another listener who says, I believe you should be licensed to get a gun like a driver's license. You have to go through driver's training and pass an eye chart test to get a driver's license. So you should have to pass a local test, psychological test, and training to own a gun of any kind, including AK-47, such as to protect against drug lords coming in from southern countries. Stephen writes, I'm not a gun aficionado. /nut or anti-gun. I don't consider myself a conspiracy theorist, but I do believe that an armed populace will prevent tyranny. You said, who thinks the government is going to take over or something like that? I reply, they haven't and they won't if each person is armed. Maybe overreaction, but it's a matter of better safe than sorry, and it stems from the fact that I don't trust the government, and there are a lot of dangerous people out and about. Deborah says there is a loophole in the California law. I know of someone who recently purchased an AK-47 in California. He got around the law by buying the gun in a non-functioning state, i.e. missing the firing pin or some such thing. I apologize for not knowing my gun anatomy. And Lily writes, my spouse is highly trained in emergency situation and trains others constantly in emergency situations. In fact, it's his job in the Navy. And yet in emergency situations, those highly trained individuals around him still panic and need to be reminded of their training. So why do we think civilians with guns who may go to the range on weekends would be able to take out an armed gunman? Want to own an assault rifle to protect our freedom? Join the National Guard. We welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. Maria says we need a grassroots movement to repeal the Second Amendment. Moderate reactions are obviously not sufficient. Helen says, I think it's important to acknowledge that there are commentators heard on our local radio stations screaming all yesterday about that Muslims were to blame and the President Obama should be impeached for advocating gun control in the face of such threats. Millions of people are listening to this and millions are agreeing. How do we counteract this? Good letter. Also, Carissa writes, most people with mental illness do not want to harm others. Also, mental illness exists throughout the world, but not the gun violence that exists here, which is a point that Libby made earlier. We welcome your comments, roundtable@wamc.org. Let's move on to some other issues. Boring week at the Capitol?
Well, actually, the action wasn't at the Capitol itself. It was at the, you know, the federal courthouse.
Yeah, but for all you Capitol reporter types.
Well, so Joe's probably mentioning things that I think most listeners might have heard by now, which is that Sheldon Silver, Speaker of the State Assembly for 21 years, was found guilty on 7 counts of selling his office. He was accused of trading official favors for $4 million that came in as legal fees, and which prosecutors successfully convinced jurors were, in fact, bribes. So Mr. Silver has left his seat. He's out of office. And now we turn to the unhealthy and unhappy conversation of what to do in Albany, if anything.
Now, let me ask another question, which your fine publication, Politico, wrote about this morning, which is the idea of Sheldon Silver's appeal and the questions that are around that this is far from a slam dunk.
Sure. So that's a very fascinating question in and of itself. The Silver case, to me, was interesting on a couple of levels. And one of them was this idea of where exactly is the line. Anyone who ever met Sheldon Silver, whether you like him, whether you despise him, most people have indicated to me that he never thought he was breaking the law. And for him, it was all about the letter of the law. So even though everything he did, I think, is I'll just call it unseemly. I don't think there's anyone who would argue that it's not unseemly to make that much money while you're the Speaker of the State Assembly, especially when some of the people who are paying you directly or indirectly have business before the state. That's unseemly. That's probably wrong. But the question was whether it was unlawful or whether there was some backflip that he was able to do that prevented it from being unlawful. And you know, Silver's defense team, and I was down a little bit for his trial. I saw the opening and the closing statements. And I think the government, in its closing statement in particular, did a very, very good job of crystallizing this case for jurors. Jurors who are not legal scholars, jurors who are not lawyers, jurors who are regular Joes, Libbies, and Judys.
But not Jimmys.
No, God, no. But I think Silver's argument and his defense was always in that sort of legal weeds. And so his attorneys are saying that that the evidence was not there, that a direct quid pro quo did not exist, that the law is either too vague or not properly interpreted. And we're going to hear appeals about this. It's going to take many more years. And I'm sure that Silver will be thinking a lot about Joe Bruno, his opposite number in Albany for so many years, whose 2009 conviction was overturned.
But that was then, and this is now, and things have changed.
That's right. So
Different players,
different standards of law. The Supreme Court ruled once on this honest services clause in relation to the Enron executives, Jeff Skilling. And so, you know, we really have to see how the appellate judges view this conviction.
I would recommend to anyone out there to check out Jimmy's piece he wrote on the prospect of reform in Albany. Wonderful analysis, a fine piece of writing. It's worth checking out. He is not optimistic about the prospect of reform.
No, thank you. It was one of the most cynical things I've ever written. And I did it when I was mad.
Do you just have a line in there, just seriously?
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
That's what Governor Cuomo, I think Governor Cuomo said that it's time for seriously
right.
to start discussing this seriously.
Seriously?
So. You know, they're not going to make any changes that affect their incumbency. It's just that simple until there's mass uprising, you know, without guns. But, you know, I would hope that somebody calls for a big march on Washington around gun violence and have 5 million people show up. And, you know, maybe it's what we need here in New York, that we need to have the people start coming to the Capitol and start demanding change, or people start, you know, challenging the incumbents in a way that will make them wake up. But, you know, the election law is written in a way that protects incumbents. The finance law is written in a way, until there's public financing, you know, which is not going to happen anytime soon, until there's some real change. You know, Preet Bharara is just sort of picking at the scabs.
You know, I'm not optimistic about the prospects for reform because of what you just said, Libby. It's like to really change the system. And there are a couple ways to do it. One way that I think is getting a little bit more focus, and I've been writing about because I think it should get some more focus, is this idea of, should we have a part-time legislature? Mm-hmm. Should legislators have side jobs like Sheldon Silver did and like many, many incumbent Democrats and Republicans, including some in this area mm-hmm. here, have.
So if it's a full-time job, you have less likelihood to get into trouble.
Less likelihood of a potential conflict.
One would think.
Yes.
I mean,
you would think.
We need to do a study, you know, to look at scandal in legislatures that are full-time versus part-time.
But the governor seems to have shot that down.
Well, the governor had a sort of middling stance. You know, we talked about this a little bit earlier this year. I almost say last year because you think in terms of the calendar.
Right.
No, it was just earlier this year that these indictments against right. Silver. And we should mention Dean Skelos, the Republican leader of the Senate, currently in court as we speak, fighting off his federal corruption charges. Don't know if he'll be found guilty or not. But, you know, they talked about this a little bit. And essentially, the governor said there was no legislative appetite. And legislators kind of shrugged a little bit at it. But so the governor says it's a good idea, but one that he doesn't think will pass. And therefore, he's not going to really put his back into it. That's essentially his position.
Was it just me, or did the Silver story not create? It didn't seem to have. I know there's a lot of things going on in the world, but it didn't seem to have the coverage or the legs that I would have expected it to.
You know, I don't know if I agree. I think that
good.
I think that when you look, especially when the indictment first was handed up by the grand jury. And when you look at the way he was ousted by his members over the course of about a week,
since February. Since the conviction, though,
I still disagree.
Okay,
I mean, it's dominating the discussion at the Capitol.
Good.
I don't think that any major state leader is going to go anywhere for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks without being confronted by a journalist or someone and saying, "So, what are you doing about this public corruption stuff?" And I think that's exactly the kind of conversation that should be had after something
I was just
like
surprised
this.
That a day later in the New York Times, you had to look for it.
Well, but the New York Post, I think, has managed to have about 4, 5, 6 columns celebrating Silver's.
Yeah, that's because
Oster.
They can do, you know, yeah. the Sally jokes.
But I think part of it is, yeah, the Shelley jokes. I think part of, and I saw something that said Silver is the new black or orange is the new silver or something like that. But I think part of it is that politics
journalism
doesn't sell papers, you know, and as much as we all would like for that to be the case, but that's not what sells the newspapers. And
well, Alan says this all the time, and he's absolutely right, that if we do a topic on the New York State Legislature or what's happening in New York State, you'll get 3 phone calls.
Right.
We do something obviously on gun violence or another issue, and we will get hundreds of letters.
You know, I had a strong appetite to read more about the Silver conviction or to find out what people were saying about it the next morning. And I did have a hard time finding
it. Yeah, I just didn't see like that in-depth coverage that you were expecting which, by the way, you had, but it was difficult, I thought, in many New York papers, but also, and that story really didn't break through into a national news cycle much either, which surprised me.
A few thoughts on that. I think that, you know, there's only so much space in most media outlets. You know, right. my publication is digital, so we can write until the banner
right.
goes
you
away.
Can do.
Yeah. And but many newspapers,
like you.
Newspapers, broadcast outlets, they have a certain amount of time. They have a certain amount of pages to fill, and so you can only fill it. And so there can only be so much news. What I've taken heart at is that there's been continued coverage. I think that the Times Union, the paper here in Albany, which does a great job and focuses a lot on political coverage, has had a story a day. And I know that in the Gazette, mm-hmm. you've had follow-ups since the actual news of the verdict came down. So I think that that's one thing. The other thing is that, you know, politicians are not running up. A lot of people aren't running to the front this, right? If you're a politician, one big politician just got found guilty. You know, basically anything you say is not going to – you're going to be tarred in some ways no matter what you say.
Right.
And I think that people are cognizant of that.
So keep a low profile.
For the midterm. And also, you know, this is a slow time for government news, right? Jewish holidays are coming. We just passed Thanksgiving.
Well,
you know,
it's Hanukkah, right?
Well, but it's the holiday season.
Yes.
I don't want to be thinking yes. about this, right? You know, what do you...
Right.
Wouldn't we rather talk about the hottest deals or the,
yes.
you know, where I'm going to shop and et cetera, et cetera.
Or what, if I'm going to shop.
But what we're still getting from politicians or from state legislatures too often is that this is an aberration. This isn't me. This isn't the system. This is an aberration. This is this one particular person. And, you know, it's as fundamental as the local senator or assemblyman having a press conference to announce a grant for a fire department, because that is something he obtained from the legislature, and whether or not they actually filed an application and it was vetted and they were deemed that they really do need that grant. I mean, that's as fundamental as it gets.
Well, there are common denominators here, and that's one of them, Judy. You mentioned this, you know, the idea that legislators have the ability to distribute money discretion with their discretion, right? That's something that came up in Silver's trial. He was able to direct $500,000 to cancer research for a doctor who then referred clients to his law firm. And by making those referrals, Silver was able to get a slice of the judgments, which was worth millions of dollars over time. So should lawmakers have that ability? Should they be able to take a pot of our taxpayer money and without even mentioning it in the budget, without lining out Niskayuna Fire Department, Alpaw's yeah. Fire Department, just send the money? Because we've seen time and again, when you have this discretion, someone's going to abuse it. It's a common denominator. And what's happened in Albany is they keep finding new pots of money to distribute discretionarily. And they've got a new one this year, the State Municipal Facilities Program. It's $1.185 billion of our money. So that hasn't changed. And the question is that going to change? That's one of the things that you could look to. You know, the outside jobs, right? Lawyer and Senator Joe Donahue, you know, works and does some side work for General Electric. He processes their tax claims in the town of Fort Edward. And is GE paying Joe $5 million for this 3 hours of work because he's the best darn tax claim lawyer in the world, or do they just want to buy his influence in the legislature? You know,
I think it's because I'm close,
right? Or whatever it is. But so that idea, it's like you'd look at that and you'd say, well, I don't know. That seems like it's really ripe for a potential conflict. And you could probably say, yeah, but then we're not going to do anything about it. That's going to go on. So there are common things we know about them.
I think a lot of the citizens naively think that the researcher down in New York City who was doing mesothelioma, and that may be a very valid thing to be studying, but I naively thought for the longest time before I got into journalism that these things were, you know, vetted through the Department of Health, which you would think would make those decisions about where best to spend our health research money. But it doesn't always happen that way.
But you know what I found sort of shocking? It was only, what, $4 million. I would have expected after
only?
20 years.
Only?
But I would have expected after 20 years it would
kind
have been a lot
consulting.
More than that. You know, I just thought, wow, you know, 20 years. I know for us, $4 million is a lot of money. But for, you know, for what some of these people walk away with, you know, I just was like, wow.
I think on the scale of New York State, that's a very high amount of money. Now, I was watching the news hour last night. You look at like Nigeria, where the oil minister is accused of taking like $20 billion. Yes, it's a pittance.
So he has something to look.
We have a higher standard. It's a higher standard.
There's
here.
A goal there. Right. We're desperately late for a break. We'll take that and we'll be back and finish up after this.
Support for WAMC comes from Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery. Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York, celebrating 25 years, specializing in custom jewelry and repair, remounts, silver jewelry, engagement rings, alternative metal wedding rings, and more. JoyellesJewelers.com. Waka Waka, solar-powered phone chargers and lights for anyone in the world living without access to electricity. Share the sun, waka-waka.com. Steve Lewis Subaru, Hadley, Massachusetts, a new and used Subaru dealer serving the Pioneer Valley, Hartford, and Springfield, offering new Subarus plus used cars, trucks, and SUVs. SteveLewisSubaru.com.
Good morning and welcome back to our roundtable panel. Jimmy Vailkind is here. Libby Post joins us. Judy Patrick, we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. A couple letters on the Sheldon Silver topic that we've been talking about. If Sheldon Silver thought that he was doing okay, writes Michael, then why did he hide some of the proceeds on his disclosure form? Then Robert makes this point. The question I have now that he is convicted, will he be allowed to remain free on bail until his appeals are exhausted? Regrettably, I expect the answer will be yes. That seems to be the norm for white-collar criminals, no matter how blatant their crimes.
I don't think that's a settled question.
Still to be determined.
Still to be determined.
Alex writes, no one is saying what has happened to the guy after being convicted isn't a regular criminal swiftly sentenced in type of letter. Sentenced and put in prison while appeals proceed. So rich white-collar politician criminals just hang out at home for years during the appeal process. And again, as Jimmy just said, that is to be determined. I think that some people like me, writes Deanne, were so disappointed about Bruno's acquittal that we feel that the same thing will happen with Silver, and therefore we don't get excited about it.
That's a pessimistic view, but it may be proven right.
Well, that's the view lots of people have about government.
Yeah.
So let's move on to at least probably our final topic here, as we only have 4 or 5 minutes left. And we go to the – you want to go to the Trump memo story?
I thought that was a great story.
Okay, great. Excellent. So the private memo lays out how the GOP would deal with Trump as its nominee. Donald Trump has become such a force in the Republican Party that the official overseeing next year's Senate races has proposed a delicate strategy for GOP candidates: tap into Trumpism without mimicking Trump. And a 7-page confidential memo that imagines Donald Trump as the party's presidential nominee, the head of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, urges candidates to adopt many of Trump's tactics, issues, and approaches, right down to adjusting the way they dress and how they use Twitter. In the memo on the Trump phenomenon, executive director Ward Baker said Republicans should embrace Trump's tough talk about China and grab onto the best elements of his anti-Washington populist agenda.
It's a story that we're going to see iterations of probably for years and years and years to come. It's this fight within the Republican Party between the establishment, which is much more toward the middle, and you can see which presidential candidates are gravitating there, and further to the right fringe. The same conflict exists in the Democratic Party between the left fringe and the center. The Democratic Party currently seems to have it a little bit more under wraps, and currently things indicate that Hillary, representing the center, is going to win the day pretty cleanly. But on the Republican side, it is still a jump ball. I have no idea what's going to happen, and I don't think any macher of the Republican Party has any idea of what is going to happen. And hence this memo, where you have a pretty prominent party official who's got to worry about the GOP's prospects in the United States Senate, where they've got, I think, 24 seats to defend this cycle? That seems like a high number. But they have at least a half dozen seats, which are close, and where they know a nominee, at the top of the ticket could drag them up or could drag them down. We saw exactly the same thing play out here in New York State in 2010. You had Rick Lazio, the establishment Republican guy with the cool confidence of, you know, the party establishment, and I'm making air quotes around that because I don't know what a party establishment anywhere is nowadays.
Right.
And, you know, he got whooped. Lazio got whooped by Carl Paladino. It's the same thing going on right now. It's very interesting to watch. And, you know, it might speak to some structural flaws in the political system.
And Paladino and Trump have the same personality traits.
They love each other. Paladino is a very Trump supporter.
And it's also about never apologizing for anything.
We are out of time. I welcome your letters, roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. Jimmy Vielkind, Judy Patrick, Libby Post, a great pleasure to have you all with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
The roundtable will continue after this.